Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Eric Larson, whose new book is The Splendid and the Vile, a saga of Churchill, family, and defiance during the Blitz. We'll also hear from Rita Woods, whose new novel is Remembrance. Larson is one of the most beloved of contemporary nonfiction authors. He's known for bringing history to life in such best-selling books as Isaac Storm, The Devil in the White City, Thunderstruck, and The Garden of Beasts, and Dead Wake. In his new book, The Splendid and the Vile, a saga of Churchill, family, and defiance during the Blitz, he has set out to find his personal Churchill, as he says, and gives us a compelling tale of family life during the first year of Churchill's service as Prime Minister. Eric Larson, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, you write in your author's note that what inspired this book was your move to New York 4 years ago and the 9/11 epiphany that came with that. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we moved for various complicated reasons to Manhattan about 4 or 5 years ago. And in the process of you know, being in New York and thinking about New York and so forth, I really did have this kind of epiphany about 9/11. Specifically, this, that when I lived in Seattle, you know, of course, you know, we watched the horror unfold in real time on CNN. It was horrific enough. But when I got to New York, and maybe this is one of those duh moments for people, but I suddenly realized the experience that New Yorkers had on that day was so radically different than anything I experienced across the country in Seattle. And specifically, you know, the fact that you know, this was happening in to New Yorkers in their home city. You know, they could see the smoke, the ambulance was screaming through the city, but you know, maybe above all was a sense of violation of their town. And then I started thinking, I can't really trace the exact sequence of thoughts, but I started thinking about the German air campaign against London, against Britain, and wondering, you know, 9/11 was so wrenching for us. What would it have been like for residents of London during World War II? I mean, as I found calculating the number of consecutive nights of bombing, there were 57 consecutive nights of bombing in the first phase of the Blitz, and then 6 months more of additional, more widely spaced raids. How do you deal with that? How do you survive something like that? And then one thing led again to another, and I thought, you know, I'm going to tell this through the eyes of the quintessential Londoner, Winston Churchill, and his family and his advisors.
And you've always loved cities anyway. You've loved thinking about their character and the things that make them places they are.
Oh, yeah. I'm a big city guy. Cities, in my books, I hope, almost become characters because they are. I mean, you know, when you think about events that take place in cities, you know, the environment, the context is really very important. Context is everything.
Now, this is your third book to draw on an aspect of World War II history, and there seems to be no end to the stories still to be told from that era. But in some ways, this is such a warm and intimate story, though it's, you know, 500 pages.
I'm lucky it's only 500 pages. Honestly, I had to cut probably the equivalent to half to another 500 pages from this book. I have to qualify that, you know, it's not World War II that draws me here. I'm in it for the story. I'm for the most powerful story I could tell. You know, within the Garden of the Beast, it was that slow descent into, well, not so slow, that descent into tyranny that was so creepy, and I wanted to try to get a sense of what that was like for people. In the case of The Splendid and the Vile, it was, again, the story. I mean, how did they do it? How did they actually manage? You know, I'm a father. I've got three daughters. three grown daughters, but you know, they accuse me of being the king of anxiety, and I'll wear that crown gladly. You know?
Yep.
But my concerns are, you know, I'm concerned about, you know, do they have the right smoke detectors, the right carbon monoxide? Do they drive carefully, and are their boyfriends okay? You know, but you know, then you think about, you know, Churchill and his family during the Blitz, and you think about the things people had to be concerned about. That is, you know, having your family blown up,
right?
You know, in a random attack, and it's like, wow, how does one actually cope with that?
Well, you really bring teenage Mary Churchill to life. It's very charming and so much fun to get to know her in this book. You said you were off in search of your personal Churchill, who is, in this book, very eccentric and interesting. And I'm continually shocked by how many people saw him in his underwear, drinking scotch in bed. You know what I mean?
Or without his underwear.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I talk about my personal Churchill, I mean something actually quite specific.
Mm-hmm.
In starting this book, I confronted something very early on that I had not thought would be as daunting as it proved to be, and that is the fact that there is so much that's been done about Churchill. You know, so much that's been done. And so, you know, I mean, you could decide, well, I'm going to read everything, and it would take you at least a decade
of course.
To do so. And even then, you wouldn't be able to finish because every year there'd be more books coming out, right? And so I had to make a decision. What am I going to do? How am I going to pursue this strategically? So I decided I'm going to read enough to learn the landscape, but then I'm going to go right to the archival sources, which is where I really feel most comfortable and most at home with the, you know, the quality of the material, the freshness and the accuracy, because, you know, documents that are in the archives were done at the time when something happened. And I decided I was going to go into the archives early in the process and try to reach my own sense of events and my own sense of Churchill. So when I talk about my personal Churchill, I wanted to see what I could come up with on my own based on everything that's in the archives and in memoirs and so forth. That made it suddenly a lot of fun. I mean, I'm not saying I was inventing anything new about Churchill, but it was just interesting because in doing it that way, I was able to look at things that maybe other scholars had overlooked or ignored and find new life in them because I was looking at the world through a particular lens, this idea of how they actually managed to cope in that era. So that's what I mean by my personal Churchill.
And you talk about some really interesting characters who cared for Churchill deeply in his inner circle. So tell us about some of those folks.
Yeah, well, one of the most important things that the takeaway is actually for me from the whole research process was that there was a tendency toward treating Churchill as if he was single-handedly won the war. And the reality is that he relied heavily on his secret circle, his family, his advisors. And among those advisors, I found a number really very, very compelling. For example, there was Frederick Lindemann, his personal scientific advisor.
The prof.
Yeah, the prof, a long-time friend, but also one of the oddest characters, this sort of tall, mm-hmm. gray, you wouldn't call him avuncular, just sort of somewhat severe, disdainful appearance, vegetarian through and through, and just very much a sort of an ascetic observer who was able, because of his position, to throw himself into anything that he wanted, therefore causing a great amount of bureaucratic chaos. But Churchill relied on him heavily, in particular in the realm of secret weapons and technology and so forth. And then there was Lord Beaverbrook, who one of Churchill's ministers describes as a goblin. Lord Beaverbrook was this enthusiastic, capricious dynamo who really saved the day in 1940 in terms of becoming the guy who was in charge of fighter production and worked pretty much miracles in that job. But these guys and their interplay with Churchill is what really fascinated me, especially Beaverbrook and, mm-hmm. and his, you know, he was like almost like a particularly brilliant, petulant child, you know. Always resigning, yeah. We don't want to say how many, we'll save that for the book, but you know how many times. But I found this aspect, the fact that Churchill did really rely heavily on people around him for comfort, for advice, or just to have them around.
Thank you. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Eric Larson, whose new book is The Splendid and the Vile, a saga of Churchill family and defiance during the Blitz. As the title indicates, this is a story of great, great contrast. And you take the title from the diary of John Colville, who's observing an evening of bombing.
So first of all, John Colville was one of Churchill's cadre of private secretaries, and they were, in fact, male private secretaries. These were really sort of assistants who were invaluable to Churchill. What made Colville particularly a compelling character is that he kept, and it was highly illegal for him to do so in terms of national security, but he kept his own daily diary. And not just a daily diary, but this exquisitely written daily diary.
Yes.
Smart guy. So he keeps this diary, and one day, in the midst of the bombing campaign, he is watching a particularly intense raid, and this is a very compelling moment to him, because as he's looking out his window, I mean, it's not some sort of drab, black-and-white war scene that he's looking at. It's this scene of absolute spectacle and beauty and the dark sky and searchlights and all this, and he talks about it as this amazing juxtaposition between natural splendor and human vileness. And as soon as I read that phrase, the title came to me. And I was like, okay, that's it.
That was it, right.
Splendor and the vile.
Now, you're the master of telling great historical events through very human details, and you're even looking at, like, the grocery receipts for Checkers for an average weekend, and,
right,
you know, what people ate, what people heard, what they smelled. Did you have a sense that you were doing something bigger than you'd done before with this book, that you were working at a different level?
Yes, I mean, in so many ways. This was a big challenge, and it was a bigger landscape than I've taken on before. I had to keep sight of the fact that my mission was different than, say, you know, the mission of Andrew Roberts, you know, who came out with a major full-life biography of Churchill in the last year or so. You know, my mission, I kept having to remind myself that that's not what I'm doing. I'm trying to do this much more intimate account to give people a glimpse of what life was really like. To me, that meant, for example, going into the files of the Ministry of Works, which handled anything having to do with the Prime Ministerial Estate Checkers or 10 Downing Street and so forth. When you have your own lens through which to look at history, suddenly you find yourself looking at things that maybe other people have not looked at or have they've disregarded because, you know, it's not part of the big Churchillian biographical landscape. But to me, it's gold. I mean, if I find out, as I did, one order of wines and spirits for Checkers and the requirements governing how Churchill was allowed or not allowed to use that for serving guests, I'm advised like second heaven. But that's just me.
Well, for readers, it's a book to live in for a long, long time. It is such a pleasure to read. So thank you very much. Oh, to have been at one of those dinner parties, huh?
Oh, my God, if only.
We've been talking with Eric Larson, whose new book is The Splendid and the Vile, a saga of Churchill, family, and defiance during the Blitz. You can meet him Friday, March 20th at the New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University. Check bookfest.tulane.edu for details. Eric, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm so excited to talk with Rita Woods today. Rita is a family doctor and the director of a wellness center in a Chicago suburb. In addition to a busy family life, she is an amazing writer, making her debut this year with a sweeping historical novel called Remembrance. Rita Woods, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is just a gorgeous book, and I love that your biography said you were inspired to write it after seeing a show about quantum mechanics. I'd love to hear how you got from there to here.
So I think seeing a show is giving it a little bit too much sophistication. I was actually in the bathroom and reading, as one does, and there was a book that was kind of quantum mechanics for dummies, and to be honest, it wasn't quite dumb enough. I still didn't get most of it. But it was talking about the relativity of time and space and trying to explain how things like fax machines work, which, as I said, I still don't understand. But one of the things that stuck with me was that relativity issue. And they gave an example with when you have two people sitting on trains that are passing each other, like at the station, and then you get a little confused about which one of you is moving, and if so, how fast relative to the other. And that sort of sparked this idea of, well, what if somebody could control that entity where two things are existing in the same space at the same time, but existing very differently?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of was the embryonic seed for that idea.
Well, your bathroom reading is much classier than mine, I must say. Now, Remembrance takes place in so many intriguing settings. Present-day Cleveland, Haiti right on the edge of the revolution, Louisiana in the 1850s, and this magical place called Remembrance that's a stop on the Underground Railroad, but kind of exists in its own time. So talk a little bit about how you mapped out this complicated story.
Initially, the story in its genesis originally was mostly about Abigail, and she's the person that is able, through her skill set, to be able to manipulate time and space. So originally it was her story, and the idea was that she had come from this place and that her powers were powered by her, or weaponized by her rage at the loss that she suffered in having to leave Haiti. But as I moved through time, the idea was originally supposed to be that she had this girl, Winter, that she raised, which would be her heir apparent, and that wasn't going to work out well. It was only like as I wrote it and it sort of developed that these other characters came into being.
And this is a very complicated story about a family of mostly healers. And
yes.
So I imagine you brought all your strengths as a doctor to that writing. But they're healers with a touch of magic as well.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah.
So talk a little bit about the research you did to create these settings. I mean, you capture New Orleans beautifully, for example.
Which, just incidentally, I've never been there. and the research for me is I tend to disappear down rabbit holes.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'll start looking up, for instance, the celebration, how Christmas was celebrated in the 1800s in New Orleans. And I get caught up in, oh, they had duck and they had pheasant and they lit candles along the Mississippi. And I know all of that. I still don't know what they did on that particular day. And then 2 hours have gone by. So that's my own little strange predilection. But since I knew that the genesis of the story was in Haiti, researching that and then sort of discovering the whole kind of history of the revolution itself, although that's not the story per se, that is the milieu in which it takes place and which triggers Abigail leaving the island. So that was just really fascinating to me. And then I did not realize that when the French planters left, they went to Cuba. There was a huge number of them went to Cuba. And then most of them had relationships already established in New Orleans as the planter class. So that was just really extremely fascinating to me.
And one of the things you do is create an entire world, something new. Remembrance, the place, is such a fine example of world building. So talk about what it was like for you to create that place of sanctuary and to imagine the rules of a functioning community that's really a defensive posture against the world outside.
I did not want the people that were there to be victims, mm-hmm. and didn't want it to be a utopia. I wanted to represent how a real functioning society would work. So these people would come to this place and they would be so extremely grateful that they had escaped such a horrendous situation. And yet at the same time, want to be self-sufficient, want to be able to declare themselves as fully functioning individuals in a really good society. So at one point in the book, Mother Abigail says, you're not required to stay here. You can move on. So, because some people had a dream of, I want to go to Canada. That I know that I have people there, or that was sort of where the North Star would lead me. But if you're going to stay here, then you have to contribute. And I had this kind of vision of this place that was, although not a utopia, was a magnificent, beautiful place where people would want to stay. There would be a school and a functioning dairy and farmland, and each person would be able to bring to this place their special skills that they'd had in slavery, but they were no longer slaves. All of their work was their own.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Rita Woods, whose new novel is Remembrance. We'll be right back. Remembrance is really a stop on the Underground Railroad, right?
It's a stop, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so these people have a choice. And often for them, this is the first choice, other than running away and stealing themselves away. This is the first choice they've ever been able to make. So this is a stop on the Underground Railroad, but you can stay here if that's what you choose to do, or recover and then move on.
And the importance of storytelling in this community is something that comes through loud and clear. I thought it was so interesting how Mother Abigail is, as you know, this is a matriarchal community.
Right.
And how Mother Abigail would kind of draw out the stories and know to wait until people were willing to tell them.
For me, that was really an interesting and important thing. Because I think when people are horrifically traumatized, and obviously slavery is traumatizing, people respond to that in different ways, it would seem to me. And there are going to be people who the way they deal with that is to shut down. It's like, I don't want to ever talk about it again. That happened, and this is my new life, and I want to move on. There are going to be people who eventually will feed out their story little by little, and you come to know over time what their story is. And then there's people who just, you know, I want to let you know what happened and move on. And I think that that was her way of giving these people space and respect. Again, to the, another thing that they could make a decision about, you're not forced to tell me what happened to you ever, if that's your choice, but we're all here to support you.
So talk a little bit for me about the title. It's such a beautiful, evocative word. It's poetry. You know, it's a wonderful word to have as a title.
Thank you. Originally, it was just I needed a place. I wanted her to be able to, it needed to have a name. And the more I thought about it, I thought Remembrance kind of spoke to, again, kind of what we had just talked about earlier, which is everyone has these memories. There's a reason we're all here, whether we share that with anybody or not. And this was Abigail's legacy, in my mind, of all of that she had been through. She would never forget her children. She would never forget her husband. She would never forget everything that brought her to this place. This was a place of memory and sort of a sort of sanctified place. And that's sort of the genesis of the name and sort of how it was a, kind of an homage to people's past.
Well, and I will say I love that it ends on a note of possibility. And maybe a sequel. I don't know.
But right.
Are you hard at work on a second book already?
I am. It's going to be historical as well. I'm from Detroit. Right now it's going to take place in 1920s to 1940s Detroit.
Fun. That will be interesting. Go back to your hometown.
Exactly.
Oh, well, thank you so much. We've been talking with Rita Woods, whose new novel, her first, is Remembrance. You can meet her at this year's Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, March 25th through 29th. Rita, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Susan, for having me.
J'ai t'oublié comment songer. On dit toi fait, toi racine. J'ai t'oublié.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week here in New Orleans. Sella Palmer discusses in Signs recipes and remembrances of Fair Dillard, 1869 to 2019, Sunday, March 8th at 2 p.m. at Octavia Books. Theo Rio Francos discusses in Signs A Planet to Win, and Daniel Denver discusses in Signs All American Nativism, Wednesday, March 11th at 6 at Octavia Books. The 17th Annual Jambalaya Writers Conference takes place Saturday, March 14th. The 17th Annual Jambalaya Writers Conference takes place Saturday, March 14th at the Terrebonne Parish Library. That's at 151 Library Drive in Ahoma. Headliners this year include Lisa Gardner, Carolyn Kapnis, romance writers Carolyn Brown and Laura Drake, novelists Samantha Downing and Maurice Carlos Ruffin, children's author Marty Dumas, and urban fantasy author Diana Rowland, many more. The New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University takes place March 19th through 21st. Headliners, you'll need a ticket for these events, include John Grisham, Malcolm Gladwell, Michael Lewis, and Sean Toohey in conversation. Other writers include Eric Larson, Nicholas Lemon, Nancy Lemon, David Brooks, Samantha Power, Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough, Dave Eggers, Eddie Claude Jr., Annette Gordon-Reed, Valerie Jarrett, Kiese Lehman, James Carville and Mary Madeline, and Susan Rice. Saturday is Family Day, which will feature family-friendly activities, a full roster of children's book authors, and book giveaways. Check out bookfest.tulane.edu for the schedule coming up in early March. March 25th through 29th brings the 34th Annual Tennessee Williams in New Orleans Literary Festival. The weekend event includes theatrical productions, walking tours, masterclasses, food events, musical performances, and literary discussion by headliners Kathleen Turner, novelist Colm Tobin, NPR's Maureen Corrigan, Jamie Attenberg, Andre Kudrescu, Beth Ann Fenley, Jewel Gomez, Saeed Jones, Sister Helen Prejean, Lee Camacho Rourke, Maurice Carlos Ruffin, John Warner Smith, Katie Simpson Smith, and Edmund White. Visit TennesseeWilliams.net for schedule and tickets. Saints and Sinners LGBTQ Literary Festival takes place March 27th through 29th, celebrating its 17th year. Featured writers this year include Jewel Gomez, Irina Klepfisch, Trevor Healy, Alex Myers, Andrew Holleran, Felice Picano, Colm Tobin, Edmund White, and many others. Visit sasfest.org for more details. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library hold its semi-annual Big Book Sale from Thursday, April 2nd to Sunday, April 5th at the Pontchartrain Center, 4545 Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are 10 to 8 Thursday through Saturday, April 2nd to 4th, and noon to 5 on Sunday, April 5th. More than 55,000 used books, puzzles, DVDs, CDs, videotapes, music tapes, and vinyl records will be offered for sale. Cash, debit cards, and major credit cards accepted, checks no longer accepted. Admission is free, lots of parking. All proceeds benefit the Jefferson Parish Library. Major support for the Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for the Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. ¶¶